Welcome everyone to the first of our roundtables in the Lex and Law podcast series. I'm joined here today by my colleagues Nessa Lynch and Eddie Clark, and we're going to have a discussion about some of the judgments that appealed to both Nessa and I over the last couple of weeks in criminal law and also in accident compensation. Because I'm going to be contributing, Eddie will be the chair of today's session.
Yeah, thanks Jeff. So to kick us off, I think you've been watching a couple of ACC appeals. First of those being the Taylor case.
Yeah, so even before we start talking about the cases, maybe just to give a bit of context, for many, many years we had very few important accident compensation cases in the higher courts. In fact, a lot of lawyers, I think, grew up, went through law school without really studying anything much past Donsalar in 1982 and barring exemplary damages, and the whole area had sort of fallen out of vogue in law schools. But recently we've had a number of really important cases, both in the High Court and the Court of Appeal, which are beginning to really challenge some of the boundaries of what we understood ACC to be. So Taylor is a common law case. It's in the tradition of Donsalar, people trying to take common law cases, even though there's accident compensation that prevents you from being able to sue. Taylor is a case that was on the evening news. Lots of people will have heard about it, maybe not focused on the legal issues so much as the factual ones. So Ms. Taylor alleged that she had been harassed and assaulted by the defendant, who was her superior in the Air Force. And this harassment and assaults had allegedly taken place when she was, as part of her duties, driving him home. And at one point she alleged that he had actually imprisoned her in a tire cage. How does this become an ACC case? Well, she sued. The defence immediately raised a number of issues. One was limitations. This all occurred quite a long time ago. The real substance of the case is about the limitations issue, but I'll put those to one side. It also is an ACC case because of old decisions that hold, of course, that we take an accident from the perspective of the victim. So even though these were intentional assaults, they are an accident from the victim's perspective. And so the traditional view would be that these are covered by accident compensation. The push me, pull you effect of accident compensation means that if you're covered by the statute in terms of being able to claim compensation from the corporation, you are barred from a common law claim under the Act. So the actual batteries were covered. The question was really about how we dealt with these false imprisonment claims, because she alleged, and her lawyers cleverly alleged, that not only had there been batteries, but on these car trips home, she had been locked in the car by the defendant so that she couldn't escape, and she had been locked into this tire cage. So was this something that's barred by accident compensation? Well, the first answer is, and the answer given by the majority, is absolutely not. Accident compensation bars physical injury. False imprisonment is not a physical injury. So that's the good part of the decision, I suppose. It's very clear. You can still sue for false imprisonment. The other way of looking at this is an overall incident. So the false imprisonment was really incidental to the assaults that the defendant was allegedly committing on her. So essentially, the majority and the plaintiff's lawyer were breaking up the incidents into different parts, allowing her to sue for some parts and not for other parts. And that may be good law. It's certainly the approach that the court's taken in some situations. But from a victim's perspective, it can also be really bad law, because the more we allow defendants to break up what's happened to the victim, we might also allow the corporation to break up what's happened to the victim. And that's the real, really interesting part of this case, which is not really developed by either the majority, perhaps more hinted at by the minority, that if you allow defendants to break this sort of situation up, you mean that the corporation is going to be able to say, well, actually, some parts of what happened to you are not covered by accident compensation. They're just false imprisonment, or there are other nasty stuff which is not a physical battery. Why is that interesting? Well, a couple of years ago, Justice Collins, when he was still in the High Court, gave a judgment in W, and I won't bore people with all of that, but the really interesting thing about W was that he took a very holistic approach to the nature of incidents which were occurring to people, so that rather than break things up into particular incidents, you took the whole incident as a whole and you required the corporation potentially to apply compensation for everything that happened to the victim in that particular context. So the case is really an important one for the common law thing, but perhaps one of the really interesting things that people haven't spent enough time thinking about is when we have these common law cases, how they affect victims who might be trying to get compensation under the system for what's happened to them.
So there's an argument here that this is a good thing on the facts, which we all agree are very terrible for Ms. Taylor, but in terms of the how it affects the ACC system going forward, there might be some difficulties.
Yeah, and the basic problem has always been in these common law ACC cases that if judges let people sue for particular things, say that's not barred by Section 137 of the Act, that has a flip side effect. Colleague of mine once called the push me pull you from Dr. Doolittle. If you pull in one direction, you push in the other direction. The result of this is that you might have the attempt to say, well, actually, some parts of this terrible incident that happened to this victim are actually not things that are compensatable under the Act. Whereas I think that the Collins approach in the W case made us look at the whole, which victims would actually prefer. It depends what place you're in and what you're trying to do. You know, one way of thinking about accident compensation is it works best when it's comprehensive. When it's not comprehensive, when we start to build in little exceptions, little islands of non-cover, we create lacuna places, you know, dark spots where people aren't getting compensation when they should be compensated.
So the other case that you were looking at, not so much about the interface between common law and ACC, but squarely in the ACC field, was the Ng case.
So Ng is just incredibly important case. It's so important that actually the High Court decision by Justice Churchman ended up in a note in the last year's budget because of the fiscal implications of his decision were so high, or horrendous, I suppose, if you were the corporation. So that case is another iteration of what is a really long-running saga in New Zealand law, perhaps the other long-running saga in New Zealand ACC law, the divide between injury and illness. As we know, the original sin of accident compensation is only injury, not illness, that's covered. And there's been lots of cases and lots of difficulties and lots of social policy problems created by this distinction. And the judges really have an impossible task to try and distinguish between these two kinds of things, but particularly problematic where the allegation is medical negligence or medical misadventure or accidents that are caused by treatment. There have been various iterations, and Ning is the latest installment of this, trying to figure out what kinds of things that go wrong when you have an operation or you have a procedure you're entitled to cover under the Act, and what kinds of things are just part of getting that treatment. And the legal test, Eddie, in the statute is whether a particular event is an ordinary consequence of treatment. So obviously if you have surgery, an ordinary consequence of surgery is that you have an incision. So clearly that shouldn't be something you should get compensation for. But Ning and lots of other claimants have said, well, what happened to us was unexpected, wasn't something we wanted, was something that was possible, but not like an incision, inevitable. It's just one of the bad things that can happen when you have a particular kind of procedure. We've got a whole history of how we deal with these, both in cases and in statutes. The previous statute up until the reform in 2005 did this really artificial, bizarre statistical stuff where it said if what happened to you was less than a 1% likelihood, then you could get cover under the Act. Everybody thought that was bonkers. And so we changed it in 2005, and the intention of the ordinary consequences test was to create a more flexible test, and that's what Justice Churchman interpreted in this case.
So thanks, Jeff. Really interesting background on the general issue, but what happened to Ng and what happened in this case?
So Ng is one of a couple of, I think it was three test cases. All of the test cases had things happen to them as part of their medical procedure, which, and there's some debates about what statistics are and what's likelihood and what's not, but people that had suffered things that were somewhere between a 10% and a 35% chance of happening as part of the procedure, and that was what happened to Ning in particular. Justice Churchman said, yes, that would be covered because it's not an ordinary consequence, because it's not greater than a 50% chance. And this, I think, greatly alarmed the corporation, because it meant that essentially lots of stuff was covered that wasn't otherwise, that they had thought would be covered. The scope was just simply too great. And what the Court of Appeal did was it said, as I understand it, in the trial in the Court of Appeal, it just said, well, that can't be the test. It actually told counsel not to really bother about debating Justice Churchman's decision, but rather what should be the test. And they resorted back in the judgment to an old case, Tiles and Hillock, which basically says, restates the language of the thing. Ordinary consequences became something that's unexpected, something that was unlooked for, or to use the phrase that Court of Appeal now uses, surprise. Now, there's a number of things about that. One is it's clearly a retraction from the width of the Churchman decision. So it means that quite a few people who would have recovered under the Churchman High Court decision will not recover under this decision. But equally, it doesn't tell us really even the results of the test cases. But it doesn't even really tell us in a predictable way what's going to happen on all of these cases that are progressing through the accident compensation system. So there's two comments you can make. First of all, is that an efficient way of having a test? Because one of the important things of accident compensation is the efficiency of the ability to make claim determinations. And you can argue that this area is just too complex, that trying to be open-textured, trying to give a factual-based interpretation may be a good idea, but it really is quite a complex matter, which is going to constantly require appeals and constantly require lawyers, essentially, to go and argue things. So is that something we want in the system? Would it be better not to say all consequences of medical treatment, except for things like incisions and operations, are covered? That might be one option. Maybe it might have been better to go with Justice Churchman's 50%. The point made by the corporation was that lots of things are not quite 50%, but which are expected. The judgment says, for example, that vomiting after having chemotherapy is not a 50% or greater consequence, but still it's something that might be expected by patients. The bigger point is it just feeds into this constant debate about why we are trying to make this distinction always between injury and illness, or injury and medical accepted medical consequences. And that perhaps just gets back to this word surprise that the court used, which I find a really interesting concept, because one of the problems with thinking about risk or thinking about what is a surprise is always from whose perspective. So from the doctor's perspective, and the evidence in these cases is always from the doctors, of course they're not surprised when something happens, because over the course of their careers they see hundreds, thousands of potential cases, and they know in a particular statistical amount of those cases things are going to go wrong. But from the poor claimant's perspective, of course, it's a terrible surprise, because people just have different appreciations of what their risk is. If you told them, I have a 10% chance of something, I'll be terribly worried by that. Eddie might be less worried by a 90% chance. What is a surprise from a particular subjective perspective? And the court really doesn't deal with that basic problem of dealing with risk and risk perception. It has a difficulty maybe of restricting too much, but ultimately it just brings back that big debate throughout New Zealand accident compensation law, which is concerned to all lawyers really. How can you distinguish between illness and injury? What do you force judges, if you're going to have these distinctions, to do in terms of convoluted reasoning? And ultimately, is it better just, as the Green Party, for example, is advocating this election, to abolish the distinction entirely? That's what I think is really interesting. It's an ongoing story. There's lots of cases that are going to go back to the district court, are going to be determined by lay assessors, by the assessors and then by the district court. It's going to take a long time to figure out what's going to happen in these cases going forward.
I also think maybe that there's something about how that word surprise will be taken by claimants. It's a particularly odd word for unforeseen medical consequences. I believe in Ng it was a stroke, and sort of saying surprise, you have a stroke, seems like a deeply unempathetic way to deal with these people who are interfacing with a government compensation system.
And I think that's just reflected on what I tried to say before, is that just people's perceptions of what risk is are different. If you're a customer in the health system, it's all, the times I've been involved with the health system, it's all a great revelation, right? It's just extraordinary what these people are doing to other people's bodies and what they can what they put up with and what they figure out and what they accept as part of their job. But I'd be very surprised when if what happened to me with the sorts of the predictions that I'm warned about in my informed consent disclosure thing.
Yeah.
And that's the basic difficulty in this area, is I'm sure Ms. Ning will remain forever surprised that she had a stroke, regardless of whether the courts ultimately say that she should have compensation or not.
Thanks, Jeff. And we have some criminal law cases that Nessa's going to talk about in a second. Just a couple of things I wanted to touch on before I passed over, also related broadly to criminal law, are a couple of interesting things about the district court in particular, but also the High Court and COVID, which is a call from the Defence Lawyers Association to review all COVID-19 prosecutions, which I believe is a little under 1,000. And I just think it's interesting, the logic here is that there is a huge backlog, and these are comparatively minor offences, not punishable by large fines or large sentences of imprisonment. So surely we can review these and see if they all need to be prosecuted. And if we just look at the sentence, that's accurate. But if we look at the context of this, which is everybody, as far as I understand, who ended up being charged with lockdown breaches had been warned multiple times. These were recidivist people with potentially significant public health effects, and there's a question about whether we need the deterrent effect if we ever have to go on lockdown again to get this compliance going on. And then the point the Defence Lawyers Association makes about backlog, the government seems to have recognised this, because I just see today that there is $50 million announced for helping address the backlog, which is significant, particularly in the District Court, but also a bit of additional help for the High Court. To get back on top of not just criminal trials but civil matters that got delayed due to COVID. Nessa, I don't know if there's anything you want to comment on that, or if we want to go into our more exciting sentencing cases.
Well, I think in relation to the compliance point, Eddie, you're right, we only have to look across the water to Victoria to show the level of compliance with lockdown number two is very low, and I think I've been questioning myself whether if we went into lockdown again, would we see different results? But you're right, there may be a deterrence effect in terms of making sure that those prosecutions are followed through. And I think you're very right also to say that these are people apparently who were warned numerous times. So shall I?
Yeah, so you've got a couple of interesting sentencing cases, both of which touch on something that wasn't supposed to be part of our law anymore, the three strikes system, but is still on the books, I think, due to opposition by New Zealand First, and we now have a couple of sentencing decisions on this.
Yeah, so I think, I suppose, in the spirit of making this quite an accessible podcast and not just one for the train spotters, that I wanted to give a little bit of background on this concept of manifest injustice, which is how these three strikes cases have come before the courts. But I think there's a really interesting piece of work, which I've got about half written on and really need to get around this concept of manifest injustice, a safety valve. Because in New Zealand, we really have very few instances of a true mandatory sentence. And so a mandatory sentence is where, as the name suggests, once you're convicted of a crime, there's a penalty, which there's no way around. And this is really common in other jurisdictions, notably the United States. And obviously there's a real potential for injustice, because you're not carrying through the normal analysis of the circumstances of the offence and offender, and it certainly leads to injustice. So generally in New Zealand we've avoided that. So for instance, our sentencing regime for murder under the Sentencing Act, it's what's known as a presumptive sentence. So if you're convicted of murder, there's a presumption that you'll get a life imprisonment sentence, but the judge has in his or her hands a safety valve, which is if the circumstances of the offence or offender mean that it would be manifestly unjust, the judge can refuse to impose life imprisonment and impose a different sentence. So again, the idea that the vast majority of people will get that sentence, but there's a bit of a safety valve. So we see this both in relation to the sentence of life imprisonment and what's known in Section 104 of the Sentencing Act as the aggravated murder. So essentially, the law distinguishes somewhat, it's a hard thing to talk about, but there are murders and there are worse murders. So there's a list of aggravating factors in Section 104 of the Sentencing Act. This could be a particularly vulnerable victim, the fact that the victim was a police officer, acting in the course of his or her duty. And what's meant to happen then is that the starting point for your imprisonment, the amount of time that you'll spend in prison without the opportunity to apply for parole, will start as 17 years. And again, we've got that manifest injustice safety valve there, if the standard is met, but it's considered that it's manifestly unjust. So where this has come up in the context of the three strikes is firstly in relation to the Section 103 brackets 2A, which is the life without parole provision. So in a MMP agreement with the ACT Party in, I remember what it would be, probably 2009, 2010, it was that we would introduce three strikes in New Zealand. So this idea that if you had a number of strikes, so you would get into the situation of a mandatory sentence, the judges wouldn't have any discretion to impose a lesser sentence. So it's really Parliament setting the direction that they believe in certain circumstances there should be no judicial discretion and the sentence should be the sentence. So there's a very interesting line of cases over the last couple of years where essentially the judges have, to use a phrase, flat out refused to impose life without parole. We've had a number of cases coming up which you could easily categorise as the worst murders, double murders, murders in the context of drug deals gone wrong, a couple of horrendous murders of women, and that they have decided that it does not meet the test for life without parole, and using the manifest injustice provision. So it won't be appropriate to talk about now, of course, but we all know that there is a case coming up which involves multiple murders, and perhaps we'll be speaking again about the availability of that sentence. But the two cases that I wanted to discuss today are in, I suppose, the less serious end of the three strikes. So we've talked about the murder and the life without parole, but the Section 86 D of the Sentencing Act implements that classic three strikes, which has filled up the prisons of California amongst a number of other places, which is essentially says, even if your offences are relatively minor, if you persist in the offending, you will end up with a maximum sentence and you won't be able to apply for parole. So the Fitzgerald case that came before the Court of Appeal, the circumstances of Mr. Fitzgerald have been through the media on a number of occasions. So he's a person who suffers from significant mental health difficulties. And what he's done is he's been convicted of a number of offences over the years, which any indecent assault is serious and it harms people. But these could easily be categorised as the more minor end of the scale. So his modus operandi was to approach women in public and either try and kiss them or indecently assault them in some way. So essentially he had become enmeshed in the three strikes regime. He had come before the courts on a third offence, which if he was convicted, it would mean that he would have to have 7 years without the opportunity for parole. So what his counsel had argued was that he should be discharged without conviction on this third strike, so arguing that he had huge mental health difficulties and these were fairly minor offences. So the question that came up to the Court of Appeal was, could he get a discharge without conviction and kind of get himself out of the web of the three strikes? So a majority of the court decided that the sentence of discharge without conviction was not available to Mr. Fitzgerald. But really interestingly, I think for future cases, the court was unanimous that, I suppose, in their dislike or disapproval of the three strikes sentencing, saying that these offences really didn't warrant imprisonment. They were quite minor. He had multiple mental health conditions. And they were really explicit in saying that the 7-year imprisonment was going to infringe Mr. Fitzgerald's right under Section 9 of the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act not to be subject to disproportionately severe punishment. And they also mentioned that they thought it would shock the conscience of properly informed New Zealanders. So a majority of the court, notwithstanding the human rights concerns, found that they had no power to impose discharge without conviction. They were forced to impose or uphold the sentence of 7 years. But again, they used the manifestly injustice safety valve to say that it shouldn't be a non-parole sentence. And indeed, they encouraged that their finding of inconsistency with the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act should be a signal to the parole board, essentially, that Mr. Fitzgerald should be given the opportunity for parole and supported. So Justice Collins actually dissented, and he would have gone for the sentence of discharge without conviction. So shall I talk about the other one as well?
Well, just to stop.
Yeah,
so was any actual declaration made in terms of formal declarations of inconsistency, or did they do a sort of indication?
Yeah, I mean, this is one probably that would be interesting to get some of our Bill of Rights colleagues in, as I can't really hugely speak to it in the New Zealand context, but my understanding is that they just stopped short of that. And obviously that might be one that's there for another day. But I think in terms of these manifestly unjust cases, the judges are getting stronger and stronger in their language around Section 9. Like, some of the early ones were fairly tentative, but this was some really strong language indicating that they thought it was contrary to Section 9.
Jeff, do you have any thoughts on that?
I know, I just found it interesting that Justice Collins does interpret this section as enabling the discharge without conviction, whereas the majority just rejects that because it basically says that the plain words are here. And the provision basically says, I understand it, that you can't get a discharge without conviction if there's a minimum sentence.
Yeah.
So the idea here is there is a minimum sentence, but it's a different kind of minimum sentence. It's a minimum sentence based on the fact that he's subject to the three strikes rule. And it did seem to me that there was a kind of legitimate argument here that was not what Parliament meant when it passed the discharge provision, which I think predated the...
And this is the kind of line that's been going in some of the murder cases as well, that Parliament couldn't possibly have intended to mean that this the three strikes with life without parole, that's what the sentence meant. So that's certainly the kind of interpretation that I think Justice Collins would have used.
It's a very back-to-basics approach to statutory interpretation, given that I'm currently teaching first-year statutory interpretation. He has a couple of headings in his dissent saying statute, text and purpose, which is very... Section 5 of the Interpretation Act, you determine the meaning of a statute from its words and in light of its purpose. So the purposive approach to interpreting statutes, as Jeff said, is not at all unusual or off-base, and I don't think that Justice Collins is stepping too far out of orthodoxy with statutory interpretation.
Whereas the majority just seem to say it was plain words, didn't they? They just seem to say it just says minimum sentence, this is a different kind of minimum sentence, but it's not still a minimum sentence, and it's just court.
And I think, as I said, going back to this whole idea of the manifest injustice, it's interesting how in so many different contexts the judges have grappled with what these two words mean. And I've been very interested in how the manifest injustice standard has been applied in relation to refusing the sentence of life imprisonment, because that's only been done in about 10 cases. And interestingly, only one of them has been a child, because obviously my interest lies very much with youth justice, and there's been numerous cases where the judges have found that it's not manifestly unjust to sentence a 14-year-old to life imprisonment. So they seem to be really keen to use it in some contexts and not others, and I haven't been able to find really
a constant thread. That all right-thinking New Zealanders apparently disapproved of the three strikes rule.
We'd all be scandalised.
and I think that...
we're properly informed.
That is a question, and I think that properly informed is a really interesting...
It's one of those legal standards that we have with the test for bias as well, with reasonably informed lay observer.
Yeah.
It's... standards that in fact seem to bear no resemblance to actual public opinion or actual people.
Because I think what the judges are probably saying here as well is that even if public opinion was massively in favour of three strikes, they'd still have to use the break or the of human rights principles.
We probably should talk about the second one in a minute, but it just always seems to me that's one of the problems with New Zealand minimums, with the maximum sentences, isn't it? That the maximum sentences in New Zealand statute book are kind of the way we describe crimes. We have a indecent assault, and then we leave the whole purpose as being not to gradate the offence in the section so much, but to leave the gradation to the judges. And so you've got your 7 years for something which I imagine is very serious, and you've got the lower level fines or other sort of sentences for dealing with things that really are still offences. But
I suppose the point of this Fitzgerald case is that the sentence of 7 years is available for very minor indecent assaults, and then that's a question of public expectation. Like, does the public expect, whereas in fact you're never going to get a 7 year sentence for this, because judges,
that's always in the paper, isn't it? They always repeat they're subject to a 7 year. They always say you're subject to a 7 years of imprisonment, and everybody knows that obviously that's not going to happen.
So if we're talking about, in the scheme of things, lower end offences with Fitzgerald, that's not the case with the other case we're talking about, Allen.
Yeah, so the Allen case was really somebody who was a fairly prolific offender. Like, I don't like to talk in terms of number of convictions, because actually it's quite shocking how many convictions some people have for various reasons. But it's clear that, unlike Fitzgerald, Allen had a long history of very serious offending, and the offence at issue here was a home invasion, very serious. But again, Mr. Allen was on his third strike, so he was going to be subject to a 7 years imprisonment, that was the maximum sentence. But I suppose this was more in line with this established tradition with the judges at this stage in relation to the three strikes sentencing, that they will really, it seems, I think I categorised it at one stage as a bit of a judicial rebellion, and I think that's quite an interesting one to think about, and the relationship between statute and the common law in relation to sentencing. But I suppose I should go back to the actual case. But what the judge found here was that there was a cultural report, a Section 27 report, and it was a narrative and a background that's all too common with people before the criminal courts. So Mr. Allen had a history of state care. He had become completely disassociated from his whānau. He had associated himself with a gang. He had both perpetrated and been subject to violence. But the judge was also confident here that Mr. Allen had prospects of rehabilitation, and again finding that a mandatory sentence would not fulfil those purposes. So the 7 year sentence has to be imposed, but a refusal to impose the non-parole sentence on the grounds of manifest injustice. But again, I suppose going back to the wider point that I've been grappling a bit in thinking about manifest injustice, is that relationship between Parliament sending a really, really clear signal through the Sentencing Act that they want offenders to be sentenced to a particular sentence, and judges doing everything they can, it seems, in some circumstances, not to do that.
Do you have another signal here?
Yeah.
In that we've got the Bill of Rights Act, which tells judges to interpret things not to be overly harsh.
Yeah, I mean, what I presented there was the devil's advocate, that I think David Seymour has publicly said in Parliament that these are judges off on their own caper, as it were, that Parliament's setting the signal and judges are doing everything they can not to impose it. But you're right. I mean, going back to our point about public opinion and the interpretation of statutes, judges also have a duty to the Bill of Rights Act and these guarantees.
But also, it's not even the Bill of Rights Act so much. It's a different approach to offending, isn't it? Because I'm not an expert on sentencing, but for the law reports, we've done quite a few of these Court of Appeal cases in the last couple of years. Zhang is the most obvious important one, where the Court of Appeal said you could take account of the fact that a supplier of methamphetamine was himself addicted, and that was something that should go to the calculation of his proper sentence, because his just measure of punishment
needed to take account of his individual circumstances. And there's been another case involving mental illness which has a similar kind of approach. And it just seems to me that the judges seem to have become more educated in how individual circumstances, and I know the work you've done, for example, pointing out that the amount of offenders who have significant brain impairments, or have injuries or have illnesses or circumstances, and the judges really seem to have learned from that, but whereas the Parliament seems not to have learned from it, and you've got these two things going on in the same space.
And I think you're right that there's an enormous argument in the literature around mandatory sentencing is unjust and we can rely on judicial discretion, but I think I will say straight up that judicial discretion has really failed us in the sentencing of children for murder, and judicial discretion has always been regarded as the safeguard, and they just haven't done it, and so which is why I've advocated for actually Parliament needs to intervene here and say explicitly that children are not subject to this presumption or a fixed sentence, because it's clear that judicial discretion isn't working.
I mean, there are a whole other series of podcasts probably on the fate of the Sentencing Commission, and the whole Sentencing Commission was designed to set up a system whereby we're not taking away from the discretion of judges, but to give judges guidelines in which to work in order to determine what the appropriate sentences were. And that became its own political football, with the previous Labour government establishing it and then the National government thinking it was essentially unconstitutional because it was affecting what judges would do. The current government hasn't really revivified the Sentencing Commission or any of those
things.
Not
as far as I've known.
So maybe that's something that might happen in a couple of months' time, who knows. But the other thing, just as you were, the driver was quite interesting, because HETA, of all the cases we've reported in the Law Report, is the Justice Fata's decision in HETA, which really gave great weight to these cultural reports and really brought in that whole economic disadvantage, colonialisation aspect. Seemed to me one of the most important decisions of the last few years, and it's really interesting to see the courts are continuing to run here. So this case is not full of, but certainly takes a real account of the whole nature of this man's upbringing and the effects that his the environment has had on him in a way that's quite stark and really interesting.
And I think those wider ideas of causation, that in the actual moment that person has the free will and has chosen to do the thing, but if you look at their background, sometimes I've heard it said about various youth court cases, well, are we at all surprised that this young person is before us on, because look at their background. And I think it goes to those wider ideas around particularly our Western ideas of accountability and the adversarial way of attributing responsibility, that we're very focused on that moment where you have the mens rea and the actus reus and all these formulaic things, but we don't really think about like that wider idea of responsibility. And I think particularly my dear colleague Elizabeth Stanley up in criminology and her work on these people that come through the state care system, and really can you say that somebody had free will when they've just had this appalling background, which was very much the fault of the state.
And that was a great theme of Justice Williams' Cook lecture last year, is the degree to which how you think about taking about the cultural colonisation thing, and how does that really affect someone's responsibility. And that was a really fantastically nuanced, I thought, discussion. It didn't discount the fact that people remain responsible for their actions, but it was within the context. You need to understand those actions. It can be different depending on... But again, that does seem to be somewhat... This judicial reliance on cultural reports or individual circumstances does seem to be somewhat at odds with the current approach of three strikes and mandatory sentences. And
I think, I suppose, building on that, in a way, sometimes these cases where somebody's had an absolutely horrendous background are easier to explain and deal with. And what we face in relation to... I did a really detailed analysis of the child perpetrated murder cases, and a lot of them fall into that bracket, but then some of them don't, and then that narrative doesn't really work, and their vulnerability arises from them being a child where they may have had a perfectly good background. And so there are so many difficulties in these nuances and people's backgrounds, but certainly I'm really keen to keep talking about this manifestly unjust standard.
And I'm sure we'll come back to it, because it's just... Because one of my things as editor of the Law Report is I come across all these things I don't know terribly much about, so these sentencing and criminal law cases are quite mysterious to me, and what's really going on in them. And so it's great. I think hopefully we'll do a bit more of the examination as we go through, because I think there's bound to be more of these individual circumstances cases coming to the Court of Appeal in the next little while, despite what the parliamentarians might be saying.
Okay, so thanks, Eddie and Nessa. I thought particularly the last bit part of the discussion is what we're really hoping to do with this podcast series, which is to give you a sense of our interest in the law and some of the really interesting things that are going on in New Zealand law generally. So about half of the podcasts we're going to do are probably going to be in this format, where we'll get some colleagues together or some people from around town or even from other towns to discuss some of these really interesting legal current developments. The other half hopefully are going to be a bit more in-depth on particular subjects. So we are going to have our colleague Marmarie Stevens going to come and talk with me about the Tikanga Alice hearing. We're hopefully going to get some of our colleagues to talk about some of their research projects. So please, as they always say at the end of any good podcast, please subscribe, give us a second chance. It'll be more like Nessa's discussion of criminal law than my discussion of ACC. But also let other people know, bear with us. Hopefully we can build a bit of a community through discussing these really interesting legal issues. Cheers.